couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Firestarter, Operation Mincemeat, Senior Year, The Kids in the Hall, and The Essex Serpent. I'm also going to be talking about the news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Uncharted. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I want to talk about hit on Thursday, and that is that Rob Reiner will be directing a sequel to This Is Spinal Tap, and he will be coming back playing Marty DeBurgi, who was, of course, the fictional film director that was profiling Spinal Tap. And, you know, on one hand, I'm excited about this because I love Spinal Tap. It's a fantastic movie. But on the other hand, I do sort of wince at it thinking, oh God, 40 years later, will they have the same magic? I mean, Rob Reiner has had a really iffy time with his films lately. I mean, his heyday of stuff was in the 80s and early 90s. But lately he hasn't done some great stuff. And also these mockumentaries, like the ones that they had in the 80s and the 90s, you know, all the ones that Christopher Guest was involved in, stuff like Waiting for Guffman and For Your Consideration and Best in Show. They even did one called Mascots, which I think is on Netflix. It's still clever and fun, but it just doesn't have the same magic. So I hope it's funny. I hope it's entertaining. I just hope it's not, you know, sad. I just hope it's not watching this thing fall apart that was trying to retain the greatness it got in the 80s. I am reluctantly excited about this. It will be coming out in early 2024, which will be marking the 40th anniversary of This Is Spinal Tap, hoping nobody has a stroke before then because these guys are getting old. Anyways, the next piece of news I want to talk about is this big hubbub that kind of showed up. And you know, you don't see this in just like the normal news. They're talking about all this other crazy stuff going on. But in terms of movie news, and you look at what film Twitter's all about, one of the things that happened last week with Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness is there are a lot of people that came out going, oh my God, that was so scary, or that was gory, or that was disturbing. Shouldn't it have gotten an R rating? And it's nonsense. Here's the thing. If you haven't seen Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, if you're one of those seven people out there who hasn't seen it, there's some horror elements to it. And this was not hidden. I mean, they hired Sam Raimi, for crying out loud. This is the guy who did The Evil Dead. And everybody from me to other film critics I knew were pointing out that this had a lot of horror elements to it. And when I say horror elements, there's like zombies and ghostly type things. And if there's anything that's gory, it either happens off screen, so it's relatively little blood, or it's almost cartoony, which is kind of what Sam Raimi's known for. He's known for this sort of Three Stooges level of slapstick humor in his horror. So people saying, oh, shouldn't this wasn't a Marvel movie. It was, oh my God, it was too disturbing. Shouldn't it have been an art? Nonsense. This is what PG-13 was made for. Remember, PG-13 does not mean family friendly or bring the kiddies. That's exactly what the 13 means. Parental guidance is suggested for children younger than 13. The actual verbiage that the MBA puts out for this is, quote, parents strongly cautioned. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13. I remember when the PG-13 rating was established, and there were a lot of people who were concerned about movies like Poltergeist and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and Gremlins that were essentially very violent or gory, or at least had elements of that in them. And that's why they created the PG-13 rating. And I remember in the 80s and seeing PG-13 rating movies and thinking, you know, before the rating, this probably would have been R or this would have been PG. It was kind of fun to try and guess where it would have gone before the PG-13 rating came out. But just because it's a PG-13 rating does not mean it's going to be squeaky clean. And also compared to the other Marvel movies, I mean, you have death and dismemberment. I mean, if Thanos literally just kills people indiscriminately, I mean, there's some pretty graphic stuff that happens in the other Marvel movies. Just because there's something that you might have been felt shocking does not mean that it deserved an R. That's nonsense. Because trust me, I've seen Sam Raimi movies that are R-rated, and this is not one of them. Speaking of Doctor Strange, a little bit of the box office. It won the box office last weekend with $187 million, which galvanizes the reality that tentpole releases like this are really the only ones that are going to be making tons of money in the theaters, while others either struggle or find a way to go online. Even something like The Bad Guys, which is considered a success, even though it's, you know, sort of middling box office. It just did a little bit better than they expected. That's a hybrid release ultimately, because this week it's on VOD. It was the very standard 17-day window. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is one that is definitely not going to get a PG-13 rating, and that is Crimes of the Future, which comes to theaters on June 3rd.
The world is a much more dangerous place now that pain has all but disappeared.
Surgery is sex, isn't it?
Is it?
You know it is. Surgery is the new sex.
They don't like what's happening with the body. In particular, what's happening with my body. Which is why I keep cutting it up.
This is the latest David Cronenberg movie, and it has been hyped up as him coming back to genre fiction. You know, going back to his earlier films, you know, stuff like Shivers and Rabbit. He did very adult content stuff that usually involved sex and violence and body horror. If you watch The Fly, that's sort of the ultimate in his body horror stuff. Even something like The Naked Lunch, which plays around with body horror and surrealism. You know, once he got to the 2000s, he started to doing more pragmatic movies. You know, he was doing stuff like Crash, which was very sexual. And then he, of course, went into like crime and stuff like that with Eastern Promises and A History of Violence. And the last movie he did that was full-on sci-fi or horror was Existence, which I absolutely love. And that came out true over 20 years ago. So this is him kind of just diving right into the body horror. It's about surgery and how it's the new drug of the future. And so there's a lot of body trauma and body horror and strange Cronenberg-looking stuff going on. So I'm real curious to see this because his stuff, he's sort of on this weird bell curve because the stuff in the middle was most mainstream stuff, like something like The Fly, as terrifying as that is, it was mainstream. But the stuff on the ends, like the earliest stuff and the later stuff, tends to get really weird and artistic and obscure. But I'm still looking forward to it because I'm a Cronenberg fan. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Avatar: The Way of Water, which comes to theaters on December 16th. I really don't know what to think about this yet. I'm sure it looks great on the big screen. I did not see this because I saw Doctor Strange in a screening and they didn't show us the trailer. So I've just seen this on my television. But it looks cool. I mean, the animation looks cool. And I've learned never to discount James Cameron because when the first Avatar came out, I remember saying on the radio, if the only way this movie's going to make money if it was the biggest movie of all time. And it was. And it was the second time he did that after Titanic. But I do think that there also is a chance that people are just curious about it and it's not going to necessarily translate into huge $3 billion box office. And I guess that's okay because the movie is about $250 million, which I guess is kind of par for the course for these tentpole movies. You know, it's right up there with Star Wars and Marvel films. But on one hand, yeah, is it going to be game-changing? Maybe. Or is it going to be like the Independence Day sequel where you realize not only have you seen all this before, but you've seen all this stuff already this year. So we'll see. I mean, there's just not enough of Avatar: The Way of Water to get any sort of read on it. And I'm curious to see it. I absolutely will check it out. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Operation Mincemeat and Senior Year.
We'll be right back.
Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about a couple things you can find on Netflix. The first one I want to talk about is Operation Minced Meat, which actually came out this past Wednesday, so you may have had a chance to see it already. In the middle of World War II, British intelligence devises an impossible disinformation plan to divert attention from an upcoming invasion.
In 5 weeks, 100,000 British forces will strike Sicily's southern shore.
Unfortunately, the Nazis know of our intentions.
We have to convince Germany that our target is Greece.
The plan begins in Spain,
where a corpse will wash up on shore bearing classified letters.
Prime Minister, that's too big a risk. The fate of the world is at stake.
The plan is highly implausible.
So when can it be ready?
This is directed by John Madden, he's a British director. I think he's most recognizable right now for having done the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. So, he's a good director, and he's a very steadied British director. And this tells a true story. They wanted to invade Italy, to sort of cut off one of the heads of the three-prong Axis powers. And so they wanted to invade Italy through Sicily, but the Axis powers also knew that they wanted to invade Italy. And one of the ways to do it was through Sicily, and that was the most obvious thing. And they're like, well, obviously we're going to do that. We need to figure out a way to take their attention and have them think we're maybe going to go through, like, Greece. And so they devise this incredibly insane, intricate plot of dropping this information attached to a dead body into Nazi hands and getting it into their hands so that they believe that the invasion is going to take place in Greece instead of the most obvious choice, which would be Sicily. And it's the essence of a spy film, because I said this back when the movie The Courier came out with Benedict Cumberbatch. When it comes to spy movies, real spy movies are not James Bond films. I mean, James Bond films are over the top and insane and crazy. And even if you go back to the original James Bond books, I've read a couple of them, the ones written by Ian Fleming, who, by the way, has his characters in this movie because he was part of British intelligence. And so they have the character of Ian Fleming kind of in the background. He's not even secondary, but more tertiary character. But even if you read those original books, the spy game is way more boring than the movies let on. Spying is a lot, it's like a John le Carré novel, people sitting in rooms listening to other people talk, sending little communiques and walking around corners. There's not a whole lot of action sequences in real spy games. So this does feel a bit like, it's not as dry as a John le Carré film, but it does have that level where they're all working behind the scenes. You're not watching a war film. It takes place during the war, but it's all the behind the scenes things and people listening to other people and them trying to come up with the perfect scenario. That's something that's just believable enough that they will fall for it, but it's not so believable that it's going to be so obvious that it was, getting that sweet spot and then getting the Germans and the Italians to not realize that this is what's going on. And so it's a real intricate cat and mouse game, and it has a great cast to it. It's got like Colin Firth in it, Kelly McDonald's in it. It's really got a good cast. Now it does sort of divert away from its point a couple times, and that's part of it. Is I think they're trying to deal with real people's lives and real things that went on with people in the true characters of the story, and I can appreciate that. Although it does get a little bit distracting at times. But overall, I mean, it's a well-made, taut thriller. I don't know my World War II history enough to know anything about this plot. And apparently there was another movie that was made probably in the 50s. But there was a lot of stuff that was classified, I think, going into the 90s. So this is supposed to be, at least as far as you can tell by watching it, supposed to be a real, true-life event. And it just feels kind of right on with that. And it's a sizzling little movie. It's really worth seeing. It's on Netflix, and it's not just standard teen audience flair. You expect something like this maybe later in the year when they're going for awards. This doesn't quite feel like a thing that they're going to drop in May a couple weeks before the next Stranger Things season. But still, I'm going to say Operation Mincemeat rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Next, I'm going to be talking about Senior Year. This also drops on Netflix this week. It stars Rebel Wilson. After falling from a cheerleading tower at age 17, a girl wakes up 20 years later from a coma and tries to recapture the glory days of her high school experience.
When I was in high school, I had the perfect life. I was already cheer captain. I had the hot boyfriend, and all that was left was prom queen. Everybody else has got to go on and live their lives. And what, I'm supposed to just jump forward? I mean, I just found out there is 8 more Fast and Furious movies. I want to go back to school, finish my senior year.
You can't let an almost 40-year-old do high school.
High school was just like yesterday for me. It will not be weird at all.
Look, we've seen these fish out of water age comedies before, you know, whether it's something where somebody's doing a body swap, like Freaky Friday, 13 going on 30, 17 again. Or if it's something where you've got an older version of somebody having to go back to high school. They did that with 21 Jump Street, Never Been Kissed. So we've seen these jokes. But you still have somewhat of an absurd story, because the whole thing centers around Rebel Wilson's character, who is basically a teenager, and she wakes up at 37 and just wants to go back to school. Now, part of the problem with this movie is, as much as I love Rebel Wilson, I support her, and I know she's recently lost weight, and which kind of puts her in a little bit more of a position to do this movie. Although, I mean, she wakes up from a coma, and they even make a joke about how large her chest is compared to the girl who plays her as a younger person, yet somehow she's still able to fit in the prom dress. So there's these weird things that happen where you're like, wait, that doesn't make any pragmatic sense. Or, I don't even know anything about cheerleadings, but that, I guarantee you, that stuff probably doesn't happen. The problem I have with this movie is, while any scene or any joke seems to work in its own, it doesn't string together. Part of it is, the character's a horrible character. I mean, she is just obsessed with popularity. And, you know, once she starts getting involved in social media, because that's the new stuff now, she's obsessing about likes and people following her, which is never should be the message. And they try to kind of give that message. But that's one of the things that always happens, because Hollywood is so narcissistic that they can't help but define their own popularity and quality by likes, yet they have real trouble sending the message of, it doesn't matter if somebody likes your Instagram post. But then there's these weird anachronisms that take place. Like, at one point they mention Instagram, but the girl went into a coma in like 2002, so I don't even think Instagram existed then. And like, there's another scene in there where she, you know, like the assistant principal is, his last name starts with T, so he refers to himself as Mr. T, and she starts making Mr. T jokes. And I'm like, wait a minute, wasn't this girl in high school in the early 2000s? Were they making Mr. T jokes? I mean, yeah, I made Mr. T jokes when I was in high school, but I went to high school in the 80s at the height of his career. I don't, there are just so many things that don't seem to make sense, and they either come out as completely tone deaf, and the characters, you don't really see a growth in characters. I love the fact that Rebel Wilson's trying to stretch her wings as an actress, and I think she should, but the character is such an under-redeemable narcissist that I don't care, and it just doesn't feel authentic. It just was a chore, and there are just too many things that left me scratching my head to actually enjoy it even as an escape thing. So I'm gonna have to say senior year sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm gonna be talking about Firestarter and the Essex Serpent. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Firestarter. This is the only one that's opening wide in theaters this week. It's also available on the Peacock streaming service. So if you have that, even if you just pay for the $5 ads included service, you still get it. Universal has been doing this with some of their movies. They did this with Marry Me. They did it with a couple movies last year, like Halloween Kills. And this is weirdly the only movie, so obviously I think Doctor Strange is going to rub roughshod over it this weekend, but it's the tale of a young girl who has the remarkable power of pyrokinesis, which allows her to start fires with mere thoughts.
It happened again.
What happened?
The bad thing.
If you ever start to lose control, what do you do?
It didn't work.
She's not a robot, Annie. She's a little girl with little girl emotions, which are wildly unpredictable.
Charlie?
She just has to shove it down and keep it hidden.
Our responsibility is getting her ready.
Our responsibility is to protect her.
Charlie?
If they catch her, they're going to put her in a cage. They're going to run tests on her for the rest of her life.
The very first Stephen King book I ever read as a kid in, I think I was actually in middle school still, was Firestarter in the summer of 1984. It was right around when the movie came out. And I actually liked the movie. I thought the movie was quite good. I was a kid in the 80s, so pretty much any movie I got to see, I generally enjoyed. But it also was the seed that got me started in reading Stephen King. And then I read the book afterwards, and really, you know, for all the complaints that Stephen King had about the book being translated into the movie that Mark Lester did back in 1984, it does follow it relatively closely. And I thought they had some pretty decent moments. In that movie, I think that Martin Sheen is chilling as the head of the shop. He's pretty effective in that movie. I thought Drew Barrymore was kind of just perfect for that role. And George C. Scott as a Native American was a little odd of a casting choice, but I loved him in a real, he just kind of chews the scenery through that movie. But even like David Keith as Andy McGee, I thought there was a certain sort of pathos to him. So I liked that movie, even though Stephen King did. And it's about running around 50% on Rotten Tomatoes. So some people liked it, some people didn't. But now they've remade it. It's the new Firestarter, and it's available on Peacock. You can watch it at home if you want to, or you can go to the theater. Zac Efron's probably the biggest name attached to this one. He is the father, Andy McGee. He's the guy that David Keith played in the original film. And the little girl who plays Charlie in it, you know, the girl with the Firestarter ability, I liked her. I thought she was really good as an actress. I don't think she was given enough to do. I think they picked some of the best parts of her clips and some of the most intense moments and put it in the trailer, but I think they kind of squander her as an actress. And the big problem I have with this movie, as much as I like the story, it feels like it's almost a low-key version. Whereas, like, you know, in the first one, the original one, and I hate to keep comparing the two, but everywhere from the beginning where they're on the run to, you know, when she lays waste to the shop at the end of the first movie, that's awesome. And it's I think it kind of completes his journey. This movie's a little clunkier. It kind of has these road signs along the way that it continues to hit, but it takes a very different path to him. It kind of diverts around. So you do not get a really cohesive movie. They have these little elements in there that you're like, oh, that's an interesting thing. You should explore that. The emotion she feels as she's developing these powers, what's causing it, that just is sort of in the background, whereas you're like, this is really interesting stuff. Because, you know, just like Carrie was a metaphor of growing older and having these changes happen and the intensity of female emotions, you have the same thing going on with this story. But I think they squander that. And there's other parts of this movie where they were really impressive and impactful, at least when I watched it as a kid, the original, that just are sort of dull in comparison. Like, there's a scene early on in the film, in the original film, where the father, Andy, has this ability to force people to do what he wants, sort of this mind control for like a very limited moment. And these people come to take Charlie away from him. And he looks at one, he goes, you're blind. And then the guy loses his sight. And he looks at the other guy and he goes, fall asleep. And the guy goes into a coma. And in the book, they talk about how bizarre it was because there's nothing afflicting this guy who's blind, but he can't see. And it just kind of this effect he had on it continues. But you really don't see it as powerfully as you do in the original movie. It's almost like too much interesting stuff happens off screen. And the development of the shop, the people who are behind this, is really kind of weak. And they bring in a character played by Kirkwood Smith right at the beginning and never bring him back. The guy just comes in there and they talk about him and he has like one scene and they never bring him back. It's like they never close that little hole. And all the development of the characters behind this, which is what I find interesting, is non-existent. So there is one thing that's really interesting about it. The soundtrack. The score is composed partly by John Carpenter. And I think they did this because this is a Blumhouse movie. And when they were working on Halloween and Halloween Kills, John Carpenter worked on those soundtracks. Obviously, he's just using his original theme from the original Halloween. And, fans of John Carpenter and fans of his work will be excited to see or hear his soundtrack in there, which is kind of neat. Also, the fact that John Carpenter almost directed the original Firestarter, but they went in a different direction, and he ended up directing Christine, which came out a year earlier. But if you're a Carpenter fan, that's a neat little tidbit to have. But you know, overall, I gotta say, I'm a little disappointed with this Firestarter. It didn't feel fleshed out. It felt everything was an afterthought. And that just doesn't make a powerful movie. So I'm going to have to say Firestarter kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Essex Serpent. This is on Apple TV+. It drops this week. Claire Danes and Tom Hiddleston star in this period drama about a woman traveling to a quiet seaside town that claims to be haunted by a giant serpent in the water.
A sea creature has been spotted.
Is there something out there?
That's what I'm here to find out. I've done some research.
Into a mythical beast?
Not mythical, real.
The serpent is an invention. A symptom of the times we live in.
So you're against progress? I'd rather believe in a creature people have actually seen than an invisible god. Is that blasphemy?
We won't get my husband to judge you, no matter how hard you try.
This is 6 or 8 episodes in the series. The first 2 episodes drop this week, and then they have one every subsequent week going on until it's finished. It's interesting enough from the fantastic side of it, but this show's really not about that. Even though you have this potentially mystical sea creature, and you're dealing with magic and religion and you know, witchcraft and that sort of thing, the show's not about that. The show's about the relationships in this village and this relationship between Claire Danes' character, who is, she's a widow, but she had an abusive husband. So she's kind of like on her own for the first time, and she's happy about that. And she's a bit of a progressive woman. And, she never wears a dress. She always wears pants, which was a big deal back then. Cause you're talking right before the turn into the 20th century. And then she's sort of falling in love with the vicar in town who's also married, and then he's played by Tom Hiddleston. But so it's this sort of this drab countryside where the sun never shines, but you know how modern cinematography is. There's an allegory to the Salem witch trials that's going on because they're saying they're enchanted by the serpent. So it does have that nod to the Salem witch trials, even to the point that they name check it at one point in the film. So if you like the slow burn, turn of the century, potential romance dramas, that's the people it's going to go for. Regency romance kind of stuff, but without the flourish, I guess. For me, where I wanted to know a little bit more about the serpent and what was happening and delving more into the complex relationship between science and religion, and it actually has some interesting demonstrations of the Dunning-Kruger effect buried into the storyline, which I kind of find fascinating, and that's a great thing to highlight in today's day and age because everybody thinks they're an expert. But some of that's just kind of squandered for the mundane banality of the people in this town. I mean, it's an interesting idea, but I haven't gotten to the end of it. Probably won't, because I have a feeling that this is going to be somewhat underwhelming for somebody like me who's going to want something more. So I'm going to have to say I was not terribly impressed with The Essex Serpent. I'm going to have to say that it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Kids in the Hall and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Uncharted. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews and finish up the new stuff with The Kids in the Hall. This is actually season 6. After being gone for almost 30 years, this upstart Canadian sketch comedy troupe returns to television with a new take on their bizarro style of humor.
Well, the curse is lifted and the kids are back.
Guys, I knew we should have cryogenically frozen our bodies.
Who's financing this time? The devil again?
Well, sort of. Amazon.
Are you crazy?
You know what Amazon wants from Kids in the Hall?
Yes, Don, a funny show, but one that is free of targets. Topical topics.
It's all a government conspiracy.
Alarming edginess or unsettling settings.
so sorry.
I've opened a can of worms, haven't I?
I'm a big fan of Kids in the Hall. I discovered them when I was in college. Actually, my sister discovered them. She was a huge fan. And at the time, this was the early 90s, but I went to school in Bowling Green. And there were two things that made Kids in the Hall very accessible for me. The first was that they were developing, well, they had, one was called the Comedy Channel and one was called HA. There were these two competing comedy networks on cable, and then they merged into Comedy Central. And Comedy Central, one of their anchor shows, ended up becoming Kids in the Hall. Also, because I went to school in Bowling Green, I was 20 miles from Toledo, which is just around the corner from Detroit and across the channel into Canada is Windsor, which we could get the Windsor station. We could pull the Windsor station out of the air because the signal just came right over the lake. Now, what was great about that is they broadcast Kids in the Hall on one of their stations. The CBC would do it. And so we could get the uncensored Kids in the Hall, that they would actually censor some things for the Comedy Central broadcast. So we watched the Kids in the Hall several seasons as they aired. And one of the things that's so fascinating about Kids in the Hall is it was like Monty Python, not Saturday Night Live. A lot of people compare it to Saturday Night Live. And I'm not comparing to Monty Python because they were in drag. Yeah, that happens. But the reason I compare it to Monty Python is, unlike Saturday Night Live, which is all very topical and news story related, the Kids in the Hall stuff was just bizarre. And yeah, sometimes there were things that somehow reacted to things going on, but they didn't do a story about the weekly news or anything like that. There's maybe stuff that was happening in the zeitgeist of the early 90s that they were riffing on, but in general, they were just doing bizarro, absurd comedy, and that stuff was funny. And so you can watch it now, and you can actually, it's on IFC. If you've got like AMC Plus, the IFC channel has all the Kids in the Hall episodes, but they censor them for language that is inappropriate now, like the F word. No, not that F word. The other F word that Buddy Cole would use, and other things they will censor. And they've taken entire sketches out. There's one sketch that has Scott Thompson in blackface. And I mean, yeah, it's offensive now, but back then it wasn't. And well, I mean, it was, but it wasn't like, it wasn't taboo. But if you've got Amazon Prime, they have all seasons uncensored on Amazon Prime. They also have Death Comes to Town, which they did for IFC about 12 years ago. So you can watch all the Kids in the Hall stuff. I still don't think you can get Brain Candy, but that's okay. Now, this new Kids in the Hall, obviously they're not kids anymore. They're all about 60, right around that age. And so they do tip a hat to that. And so it's not just them doing the same bits that they did when they were in their 20s. They're older, they're more mature. That doesn't mean that the comedy's more mature. They still have some skating stuff, and they do have some raw stuff. It's on Amazon, so it's on Prime Video, and there's no standards and practices there. Trust me, there's things that you're going to see in there that you probably never really wanted to see on a Kids in the Hall episode or a Kids in the Hall body. But they have the same spirit, and they have the same touch. And unfortunately, it's only 6 episodes. Whereas the series, when it was on TV, well, there was like 20-some episodes a season. So, you know, we're dealing with short streaming runs that are more similar to the length of something that you see in Britain. But I gotta say, Kids in the Hall are back. They're very, very funny. They're biting. They're sarcastic. They don't take prisoners. And what's nice about them, they don't try to be offensive, but when they're offensive, they don't care. And they bring back some of the old classic characters. You get the guy wanting to crush heads. They don't bring back the chicken lady, which is a little bit upsetting. They don't bring back Cabbage Head. There's a bunch of them they don't bring back. But then again, they only had 6 episodes. There's only so much you can do. And they had enough new stuff in there that they weren't just replaying their hits, which is why I think they just didn't do everything. And most likely they're looking to get another season. So, you know, maybe we'll see the chicken lady show up again. Also, it's worth noting that on Prime Video, they have these documentaries about Kids in the Hall. There's about 2 hours, an hour and a half worth of documentaries of them talking about how the troupe started and, you know, where they got their genesis. And some were from like Calgary and some were from Toronto and how they got together. And that's actually really interesting for people who are diehard fans of Kids in the Hall. So definitely worth checking out if you're a fan. It is not for the easily offended, but that's okay. I'm not easily offended. So I'm going to have to say the Kids in the Hall season 6 totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Uncharted, which was a movie that came out in February and was kind of a surprise hit. I don't think people expected this to do as well as it did. But this one stars Mark Wahlberg and Tom Holland, and it's based on the Uncharted video game series. Tom Holland stars as a young man recruited into a quest to find a lost treasure worth billions of dollars.
Everything in here. Why the map?
It's the biggest treasure that's never been found.
5 billion, easy.
But it's just a story.
I beg to differ.
500 years ago, my family found the world's biggest fortune, then was betrayed.
Oh, this is gonna suck!
Your brother believed that there was a final piece.
Well, you know my brother's sick.
You have no idea who you partnered with.
Okay, just on the surface, this is just a fun adventure. It's you know, fortune and glory treasure hunt. That's really all it needs to be. And there's a lot of things that go really right with this movie. And they could go disastrously wrong, and we've seen that happen. But some of the things that go right, first of all, Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg have great chemistry together. Second of all, they don't overdo it. In terms of the story, they don't put so much backstory in this, you can't follow it. It's a relatively simple setup. And if you've seen enough treasure hunt movies, it hits all the right beats. And, you know, you have them going into traps and underground and into deserts and jungles and everything like that. It also has some great special effects and some action. Yeah, some of the special effects do break down in the action sequences, I will admit. But it's an exhilarating type movie to watch. Now, one of the things that kind of, I think, surprised a lot of people is, notoriously, movies based on video games rarely do well. You have the outliers like the first Resident Evil, but they had diminishing returns over the 20 years they made them, or something like Sonic the Hedgehog, because both those movies did quite well. But one of the things that I think was the key to this movie is, I've never played the video game. I don't know anything about the video game. The first time I've seen any pieces of gameplay of this video game are in the behind-the-scenes stuff that they show. But I, A, was able to follow it, and B, I had fun watching it. What they did is they took the very basic background of the video game, and then they just told a story. They didn't try to adhere so closely to the video game that it got confusing. Like, if you go watch Warcraft, the movie, it's nonsensical if you don't play the video game. You don't know what's going on when the politics of the people or the orcs or whatever. What's nice about this is a very simple setup. You can fall right into it, and they have the Easter eggs in there for people who play the video game, but it doesn't seem bizarre. And like, even like something like Tomb Raider, it felt like Tomb Raider was playing fan service to the video game fans, but forgetting the fact that people needed to go see this as a movie. So this one works. You can know nothing about the video game. You cannot even be aware that it's based on a video game, and you can watch this movie and find something to enjoy about it. I certainly did. I enjoyed it a lot. I surprised. And a lot of people were like, oh, it's because Tom Holland just got off of Spider-Man. Nah, I don't think that's it. It didn't hurt. But this was a big screen adventure movie, and it was, you know, it deals with some really neat stuff that you may have seen certain things on the screen before like this, but it does kind of own it itself. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. I surprisingly enjoyed it. And the Blu-ray comes with a whole bunch of extras. It does have a bunch of behind the scenes. It got a director's commentary and deleted and extended scenes, but you know, a lot of the behind the scenes stuff where they talk about the movie. One of the problems, and this tends to be something I noticed recently with Sony's discs, is behind-the-scenes videos are really them just patting themselves on the back, and it's like they're trying to encourage you to watch the movie, but generally you've seen the movie by the time you're watching the extras, so there's not a whole lot of good content in the extras. There's the one that was interesting was them talking about how they based it on the video game, and I found that kind of interesting, because I never played it. But, you know, aside from that, the special features aren't stellar, although there's a good amount of them. But still, I'm going to say that Uncharted totally rocked. I enjoyed it.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that's it. I got to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Downton Abbey, A New Era, and Men. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.